This podcast discusses topics involving human death. Listener discretion is advised. My name is Ivy, and welcome to the Taphophile Diaries. A taphophile, also sometimes called a tombstone tourist, is defined as an individual who has a passion for and enjoyment of cemeteries, epitaphs, gravestone rubbing, photography, art, and history of deaths. So, if this sounds like you, you might just be a taphophile. Episode 1. How to Bury a Vampire. Imagine this. It is the medieval period and someone in your town has come down with mysterious symptoms. Symptoms which you've never seen before. Soon after falling ill, they die. After their passing, someone else close to them falls ill with the same symptoms, and they die, then someone else, etc. With our modern knowledge, we know that some kind of disease was likely to blame. But back then, we didn't really know about germs and how diseases spread. So, instead of using natural explanations for the suffering and death that they saw, they often used supernatural explanations, and vampires were one of them. A belief in vampiric-like beings has existed for centuries. However, the term vampire wouldn't appear in the English language until around 1732. And these early vampires weren't quite the sexy and sparkly figures we see today, which evolved from the romanticized vampires we see in later writings and novels, like Varney the Vampire in 1845, and, of course, Dracula in 1897. Instead, these earlier vampiric beings were often depicted as being rather pale and decayed, with nasty, tattered burial shrouds, and they would feed on the life force or blood of the living while spreading disease. Two such diseases were the bubonic plague, also known as the Black Death, and tuberculosis, also known as consumption. And we can directly link diseases such as these to vampires, not just in the belief that vampires spread disease, but the physical evidence that we find in graves of suspected vampires. As for what some of this evidence entails, I'll get to that more soon, but DNA extracted from teeth in old burials can tell us what may have inflicted someone before they died. And sometimes physical marks can also be left on their bones, such as lesions on the rib bones from someone who died of tuberculosis. This is how we have positively identified a connection between disease and vampires. I should note that vampire lore is vast. People with uncommon physical features, people who faced a quote-unquote bad death, such as murder, people who simply drank too much, or outsiders, were also believed to be more likely to turn into a vampire after their death. But disease seems to be a main culprit and a main focus in a lot of vampire fears, that these vampires were responsible for spreading these diseases and killing people. Now that we know more about the history behind vampires, who they are, what they did, how would you identify a vampire? To do this, the grave of the suspected vampire would be exhumed and they would look for signs of life. This could include a lack of decay, which could be caused naturally by cold weather or an airtight coffin or other reasons, but back then they didn't know any better. So to exhume a body and find that the person looked remarkably the same as the day they were buried was suspicious. Or, simultaneously, the normal signs of decay could also be mistaken for signs of life. If the body of a suspected vampire was exhumed not long after death, their corpse might still be bloated with the normal gases that come with human decomposition, giving them a distended belly and blood or other fluids oozing from the mouth. This made it appear as if the corpse was reanimated and had left their grave to feed, with their belly being so full of the blood of their recent victims, blood that you can still see around their mouth. Other stages of decay can involve the tissues becoming dry and shrinking, making it look as though the corpse's hair and nails have grown, also alluding to them being reanimated. Their teeth can also look elongated as the gums recede, so another very classic vampire characteristic. Their teeth looked perfect to use to feed on the living. Keep in mind that the average person back then didn't witness the stages of human decay. When people died, they were usually buried or dealt with pretty quickly, so how could they have known that this was all normal? So now that you've successfully completed a lesson on Vampire 101, albeit a very brief lesson, again, vampire lore is very vast and varied, but I want to get to the real topic of this episode, how to bury a vampire. How is it that we can exhume a grave and know that they were a vampire? Well, oftentimes there are surviving items that were buried with the person or things that were done to their body. We are all familiar with the classic wooden stake through the heart of the vampire. This is somewhat historically accurate, but people weren't stabbing vampires rushing towards them that quickly turned into dust, like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Instead, as mentioned earlier, graves were exhumed and they looked for signs of life. And if they found any, there were a variety of ways to kill and rebury the quote-unquote vampire. Or, sometimes, anti-vampire methods or rituals could be used as a preventative measure while burying someone believed to be at risk of turning. And it is evidence of such things that we find in graves which tells us if the person was a suspected vampire. So although wooden stakes don't really hold up well to the test of time, iron rods that were used to pierce the chest of a vampire do tend to survive. One example is that of a young man who was unearthed by Bulgarian archaeologists who had an iron rod pierced through his chest. Because Bulgarian villages did have a culture around anti-vampire practices up until the early 20th century, this did leave some experts to believing that this young man had been believed to be a vampire. As for why iron was used, it's possible that the metaphysical properties associated with some metals, like iron, would spiritually keep the vampire from harming someone. Or, it's more simple, and people believed that staking them in the grave would physically pin them down and keep them restrained, and unable to leave their grave to spread disease and cause harm to the living. Another common method for killing a vampire was via exhuming the vampire's grave and decapitating them. Or they could be decapitated at the initial burial as a safety measure. The head was usually placed at their side or their feet, and we see one of many examples of this practice in a Polish mass grave dating back to the 1800s. Of the approximate 450 bodies they exhumed, several had been decapitated, with their head placed between their legs and a coin left in their mouth. Both common signs of anti-vampire rituals that were common in the 19th century. The coin helped to seal in their soul and gave them the currency needed to travel in the afterlife. Other than removing the head of the vampire, more creative preventative measures could be taken, such as burying someone with a scythe or sickle in front of their neck. The sharp blade would ensure that if they turned and became a vampire, and had they sat up to leave their grave to attack the living, their head would be severed on the spot. Or, like I mentioned with the iron rods used to stake them, the metaphysical properties of iron being placed around the neck of the vampire may have spiritually done something to trap them as well. Today, we still uncover graves like this, with one such discovery happening as recently as August of 2022, when the remains of a woman were unearthed at another archaeological site in Poland, with a sickle being clearly present and, by all accounts, deliberately placed around the woman's neck, likely to prevent her from turning. Anti-vampire practices didn't have to be so elaborate. Something as simple as a rock or brick placed in the mouth of a suspected vampire could also suffice, keeping the vampire from chewing through their shrouds and escaping to spread disease among the living. We believe this originates from the way burial shrouds can sink into the mouth of a corpse as they decompose and their jaw opens and hangs loose. This can make it appear as if the corpse had been breathing and sucked it in. Having a blockage in the throat could also prevent them from feeding or keep their soul trapped inside their body, preventing it from leaving. Evidence of this anti-vampire practice can be seen in the grave of a child who was believed to have died of malaria in the 5th century in Italy, as they were buried with a large rock in their mouth. Also in Italy, the remains of a woman in a plague pit from the 1500s showed a lingering belief in this custom, with the woman having been seemingly buried with a large brick shoved into her mouth as well. I'll note that I utilize words like seemingly in this episode because we cannot always be 100% certain about everything. Even archaeologists and historians still debate about some aspects of vampire beliefs and burials. And to piece together human history, we have to simply find as much documentation and evidence as possible and give the rest our best guess. And when we have, for example, a plague victim with a brick shoved in their mouth, someone fearing they were a vampire and doing this on purpose is a very good possibility. This next method is one of my personal favorites that I saved for last, due to how utterly strange it gets. Because to deal with a vampire, their grave could be exhumed and simply be burned. Or just their heart could be removed and burned, or sometimes the heart could be removed, cooked, and eaten by someone who was being afflicted by the vampire as a means of not only killing the vampire, but also curing themselves. And one such example can actually be seen here in the United States in the New England grave of Mercy Brown. In 1892, tuberculosis was a leading cause of death in the U.S. But when people began to fall ill and die in Rhode Island in the late 1800s, one of the first victims of this specific outbreak, Mercy Brown, would be blamed. To find out if she was, indeed, a vampire, her body was exhumed to look for signs of life. So, 9 weeks after her death, Mercy was exhumed, and lo and behold, she looked remarkably well-preserved. Mind you, Mercy was buried in the cold winter months, so naturally she would be decaying rather slowly. One local doctor did try to explain that the cold temperatures are why she looked essentially the same as the day she was buried, but their superstitions won. And in their eyes, this was proof that Mercy was a vampire who was now killing off her relatives and others in the same manner of her own death. Her heart and liver were then removed, burned, and the ashes were mixed in with water to feed a young man who fell ill. But this attempt at a cure did not work, and he, too, passed away from what we can now confidently say, based on examinations of her remains, was likely tuberculosis. It is utterly wild to imagine that this strong belief in vampires still existed in the United States as recently as the late 1800s, but it did, and if anything, this shows us just how deeply people were hurt and affected by all of the suffering and death that they saw, and how desperate they were for answers, and how they were willing to try anything as a means of a cure. As very dark and macabre as a subject this is, I also cannot imagine the excitement of working on an archaeological site and making such an incredible find. To find someone with a sickle on their neck or their head laying at their feet and knowing that you've possibly uncovered a suspected vampire. Or maybe this is just my inner taphophile and vampire lover speaking, but I'm sure people listening can relate. I should also mention that there are more commonly debated grave elements that some attribute to the buried being a suspected vampire, but some don't. A good example is finding a pile of rocks or a large stone covering a grave. Some claim that this kept a vampire from rising from the ground, but many argue that this was for more simple and practical reasons, to keep animals and grave robbers from digging a body up. But I suppose it could be a little of both. I do have to end this episode with a fun fact about myself, because some vampire lore states that people born with an amniotic membrane still covering their face, also known as being born with a quote-unquote veil, are likely to turn into a vampire when they die. And my mother has always told me that I was one such baby who was born with a veil over their face. So now, I just have to pick which anti-vampire method should be deployed someday at my funeral. With that, I will conclude episode 1. Let me know what your thoughts are on vampire lore, burials, and what your favorite anti-vampire burial method is, and if I maybe left one out. My sources for this episode, and other helpful sources if you want to learn more on the subject of vampires and vampire graves, are all linked in the show notes below. Be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at The Taphophile Diaries for photos and updates on future episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave a rating, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. This is the best and easiest way to show your support for your favorite podcasts. And don't forget to join me next time for episode 2 of The Taphophile Diaries. This podcast is produced, researched, and edited by me, Ivy Boyd. Music is by Dimitri Terrace from Pixabay.